Hello, everybody. It's another beautiful day in Prince Edward Island. We're here in Charlottetown waterfront, overlooking the yacht club as usual. And you said it was the first day of the fall?
First day of the fall today, yes.
Actually, you said it was the first day of spring.
Well, I made a mistake. And to add, we have two cruise ships coming in today, Michael.
Well, we're going to have to get out and get some walking, some pictures and video done for sure. Welcome to the Michael and Patty Show. I'm Michael.
And I'm Patty.
This is where we put the real in PEI Real Estate, Prince Edward Island's best resource for Prince Edward Island real estate and everything PEI, if I may say so myself.
Yes. Yeah.
If you're new to the podcast, Patty and I bring you over four decades of hands-on, full-time PEI real estate experience, thousands of transactions handled, and no self-promotion. We're completely transparent. Our only goal here is to help buyers and sellers of real estate and PEI, and for that matter, anywhere in North America, because it's basically the same stuff. This doesn't just apply to the podcast, but also our new Facebook group, which we're up to about 748 members, and there's all kinds of stuff going on there now. And one of those subjects, which Patty says is a fairly niche subject, I don't look at it this way because I've done tons and tons of these applications, but apparently, according to Patty, they are reasonably rare. And I would suspect that's because the lack of U.S. buyers that we used to have before gobbling up all the waterfront properties. What we're talking about is IRAC, Island Regulatory Appeals Commission. If you're looking for information on it, go to irac.pe.ca. And maybe you, Patty, can tell us about the Facebook comment and what we rattled on about in the group.
Yes. Well, I'm not saying that it is a rare instance that someone has to put in an IRAC application. I am, based on conversation and communication with other members of the Prince Edward Island Real Estate Association, am realizing that not, especially because we've had so many new agents, sales representatives getting into the business as a result of the pandemic, that they don't have the skills set of dealing with IRAC and how to best advise a client with regards to when do I get to submit an offer? You're really interested in this property, but according to IRAC, because it exceeds 5 acres or 165 feet of water frontage, there is a 90-day advertising requirement so that it gives fair opportunity or first opportunity to island residents to purchase or secure that property to try to maintain Prince Edward Island in the land of islanders. So that's the whole purpose of this IRAC application process and the 90 days advertising requirement. Now, best practice is to have it listed with a real estate agent because one would then be able to argue with IRAC in their application that there's been mass marketing or high exposure, which Realtor.ca these properties would be featured on and be able to not only be promoted across Canada and Prince Edward Island, but anyone around the planet would be able to see this property. Another requirement of the Advertising Act, and then I'm going to get into the question, is there should be a sign or some sort of signage as well on the property so locals in the area are able to see it while they're driving by and maybe they have a family member or friend or themselves personally might be interested. So the question that came in to our Facebook group was a very good question. That it is a buyer, they're from Quebec, they've been waiting for the 90-day period before making an offer. Their realtor ended up calling them and telling them that there has been an offer made by a non-island resident. This buyer is letting us know that it was only 72 days, and is this legit with IRAC? The buyer's a little confused, and rightfully so, or the interested party, because obviously they're not buying the property if it's already under contract. So there's a few ways that, and Michael and I were discussing this to try to unpack it, And Michael has a very strong opinion on his position. And I also have a very strong opinion with regards to what would have been the best advice to give to this particular interested buyer in this IRAC applicable property. So this buyer was responded to and had been informed that typically, if we are an agent who is very familiar with IRAC and the 90-day advertising requirement, we would be telling them to wait to submit their offer as close to the 90 days as possible. If they want to go ahead and submit their offer, obviously we would be able to do that, and they would just submit their offer with an IRAC condition to the listing agent. Now, Michael, you can tell me your opinion with regards to, okay, let me just explain. So the buyer's agent submits on the buyer's behalf an offer to the listing agent. The listing agent receives it. The listing agent presents this offer to the seller, reminds the seller that it is with prior to, whether it's 10 days or 60 days into the advertising requirement, that IRAC is looking for the 90 days. Now, that seller can go ahead and accept the offer, or what, if they're going to change any conditions or maybe the price or anything like that, it would be best practice, in my opinion, as a listing agent, to advise that seller to also counter with a clause that states that if an island resident submits an offer within and by a certain date, that offer would, that they deem acceptable to themselves, then that this particular offer or offer number one would become null and void up to a certain date. Because once the buyer submits their IRAC application, they should not be in a position that they have to concern themselves with being bumped. Now, a buyer can at any time submit an IRAC application, but in my opinion, you're doing a disservice to that particular buyer. Because let's just say the property is a $400,000 property, which means the IRAC application is 1% of purchase price or $4,000. If they submit it too soon, they run the risk of being rejected. If they're rejected, at best, they could get maybe half of the application fee back, but they also have to make sure that they've been advised that they have to submit a request for the half. It is not automatically reimbursed back to you. So it's a little bit of a tightrope. Now, again, the buyer can submit at any time. A listing agent, if they're savvy and they know what they're doing, could always counter that it is until a certain date that the seller has the opportunity to secure an agreement of purchase and sale with an island resident so that they wouldn't run into any issues with IRAC. Now, Michael, I know you have a different opinion on this.
The original question, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, in the Facebook group was, actually, it was a statement and a question. So the statement was, his agent advised him to wait 90 days before making an offer, which from what I hear from you, you agree with his agent's recommendation.
I didn't say wait to 90 days. And
what did you say?
I said an agent can submit an offer at any time on behalf of a buyer with an IRAC condition. It is up to the listing agent as to how they respond to it. However, a buyer's agent, if they're savvy with IRAC, needs to make sure that that buyer is well informed that if they submit it too early, they may run the risk of being rejected. Not that we should be making that decision for them. Our role and responsibility is to at least educate them of the possibilities.
So the property's been on for 3 days on MLS. I checked the history. Or I shouldn't say I checked the history. That's what it says on the cut sheet. Number one, I should be checking the history, should I not?
Correct.
Because some agents will list properties for short term, so it keeps every 90 days refreshing that listed date. So it looks like a new listing. So the first thing you want to do is type that PID number in or have the agent do it on their local system, which is Paragon, and see what the history of that property could have been on the market for 5 years, even though it says it's only been on for 4 or 5 days. If a property has only been on for 2 or 3 days, would you advise the client to write an offer?
Me, personally, I would go over what I just said, so no.
Let's assume the client is hugely wealthy. They love the property. They've been looking for decades, and they have seen this particular property. Every time they drive by, the wife gets excited and says, if that ever becomes available, I want to buy it, and I don't care what it costs because we're rich. They want to put in an offer on this $400,000 asking price of $500,000 with no conditions. They're going to write a check out for $500,000 to the listing brokerage in trust, which would be the same as escrow in the States. That is to be presented to the listing agent, and it's subject to IRAC. Do you think that would be an advantageous thing to present 2 or 3 days into the listing, or should they wait? I think in this particular analogy or situation, I want to make it clear to the vendor that 500 grand is sitting in a trust account and it's all theirs. All they have to do is wait for IRAC approval. So what are they going to do? They're going to reject and not be very accepting of other offers that have a list of contingencies, which they typically do, and they're not going to come in at asking price.
Well, that goes against so as part of the IRAC application process, a listing agent has a responsibility to state how many inquiries they received, how many from island residents, how many offers have they received, was there any offers received from island residents. They want to know a little bit more detail about the offers, offered price, etc. Why were they rejected? So what you're saying is, as a listing agent, would you disclose all this declining or rejecting of these future offers, especially if one was lower than but by an island resident?
Usually what they ask for is, has there been any interest in the property from island residents at such time as you can just be honest and say, yes, there has been?
They want more detail than that.
Yes, there has been some interest.
I don't know what your experience has been.
My experience has been, as the listing agent will write an offer, they say, yeah, we've had some interest in the property. We've had an offer or two that were unacceptable. End of story.
Well, then they'll also align it with the dates of the purchase and sale agreement, because IRAC will request the agreement of purchase and sale as part of their IRAC application. And this is the buyer, not the listing agent. So the buyers has to submit an application, preferably through their lawyer. They will have the land configuration. They will have their agreement of purchase and sale. They will have what is their intention in moving to Prince Edward Island or securing a secondary home. So that's all part of the buyer's responsibility. The seller's responsibility, which they need the assistance of their listing agent, is to be able to provide a letter saying, why should this seller be allowed to sell to this particular buyer? So the seller has to be able to, and again, this is the listing agent's responsibility, to say, this is what was done to market my property. This is, you know, how many inquiries, because they're trusting all the information provided by their listing agent. So that's what this whole practice, this whole process looks like when you are dealing with IRAC. I would never recommend to a seller that they would reject offers. If they don't like the price, that's fine. If you have a client like yours, Michael, that's willing to pay over $100,000 above list price because it is the property of their dreams and they have cost is no concern to them, well then I still need to sleep at night and I need to lay my head down on my pillow.
It has nothing to do with sleeping. You've got someone that's motivated.
I need to properly advise my seller. That's fine. Whatever the buyer's motivation is, I need to best advise my seller to set everybody up for success and not red flag my seller's property.
Not turning this into an whole episode on IRAC. You got a seller that can't get a clean offer, even close to asking price. You got one buyer that's willing to pay 500 cash with no contingencies, willing to close as soon as possible, as soon as they get IRAC approval. you've advised them, any owner with any common sense is going to try to do everything they can to put that offer into play, which comes back to the original question, do you put your offer in right away? It depends on the buyer, the motivation, the financial risk they can tolerate, whether they can afford to throw away 1% of $500,000 and only get back possibly half. So bottom line, it depends on the purchaser. Let's not worry about the listing side at this point, but do check the history to make sure that even though that property says it's been on the market for 72 days, in Patty's example, it hasn't in fact been on for 3 years. Done?
100%.
Let's move on.
No, and I will say, for this particular inquiry, if your agent had checked the history, you could have submitted your offer. It's all in how the listing agent wanted to respond and handle it. So it wasn't so black and white saying you can't submit an offer. It's never so black and white. There's a little bit more that could be involved.
So the advice that the agent gave to the purchaser, which is Dennis.
Yes.
Or is it Denis? Patty and I are both taking French, and it's spelled D-E-N-I-S, so that would be Denis. So hello, Denis. See what kind of controversy you and your agent have started here? Bottom line is you don't tell somebody they have to wait 90 days. If I'm a purchaser, I'm motivated, I got oodles of cash, I want to get my offer in there the day the listing shows live because I want to plant that seed in the vendor's head. So hopefully they're going to do everything they can to accept my offer. Moving along to something you can cover.
What's that?
The properties an agent lists will produce the buyers that would be attracted to that type of listing. An example might be, I specialize in rusty old 50-year-old mini homes up west.
And that
off the grid.
Yes.
Under $5,000. Is that going to attract people looking for waterfront houses for $2 million on a white sandy beach in Surrey?
No, and there's a good reason for it. The reason is when a buyer is looking for a property of certain niche products, whether it's, like you said, a rusty old mini home or a farm property or a cottage recreational or a residential property, you want to make sure that you're dealing with that particular kind of agent because, as we just covered with Denis, if you have an agent that may not be so savvy with IRAC applicable properties, you may not be getting the best service or advice. If you're dealing with someone with cottage rec properties, which I know you have specialized in, Michael, for years, decades, you know all the ins and outs and are able to predict or foresee these might be issues based on the profile of that particular buyer client and maybe be able to advise your seller of some issues that might arise and collect the right data or information. Farm properties is another niche kind of market. You want to make sure that a farm property isn't just about purchasing the barns and the house and the arable land. There could be far more details in there based on who's their supplier for their feed, their how much feed, what is their numbers. A typical agent who's not savvy in farm properties would not know to ask certain questions like that, but a farm realtor would know. So it's really important. And then you end up attracting those kind of buyers, hopefully, unless you're not knowledgeable as a buyer and just assume all realtors are the same. We are not. We each will have our own kind of niche market that we seem to just feel far more confident in or have the skill set, experience in. And those will be the types of buyers that should end up being attracted to those particular agents with that skill set. So that's just to be knowledgeable if you're a buyer, not just to call any random person, ask them, what kind of properties do you typically sell? Because you want to make sure you're being properly advised and serviced. Good, Michael?
Very good, Patty. I was just looking at the fancy, loud sports car that just pulled in beside us.
Yes.
From our podcast, we always tell you to deal with an experienced agent. That comes down to somebody with 10,000 hours of full-time PEI, real estate experience, which works out to 5 years and 1,000 transactions handled. But I was listening to a podcast here that was quite interesting. It's a real estate podcast, mainly for real estate agents and brokers. And what they said is they said they knew of an agent that was 19 years old that did 100 transactions in his first year, which is truly exceptional. Awesome. Most agents don't see 100 transactions in a year ever. Some of them might see it in decades, but 100 transactions in a year is fantastic. Would you consider that person an expert?
I wouldn't say necessarily an expert, but whatever they're doing it right. If they can repeat it a couple times, absolutely. So one deal equals a month's experience. So that means that particular newer agent or young agent, we will say, has what would that work out to? About 5 years experience already as a result of those 100 transactions?
I've lost you in the math.
Oh, well, you're saying they did 100 transactions and one transaction is equal to 1 month's experience. So 12 transactions.
So it's 100 months. So it's 100 divided by 12.
That's why I said about 5 years at least.
Yep. At least 5 years.
There's the math.
What did this agent do for the agents and brokers that are listening to this podcast? I'll ask you, did he find some secret recipe, secret methodology, a secret training course? Maybe a secret YouTube video that gave him the inside secrets to being successful at real estate? Maybe he took an abundance of courses. What did he do?
Well, I don't know this particular situation that you're referring to, but in my best guesstimate would be this particular agent marketed himself, put him into circles, spheres, because it's a relationship-based business.
It's such a complicated... You know what he did?
What? He worked.
And you can't sell a course on this because it'd only be 2 or 3 minutes long, and
you couldn't
charge thousands of dollars for this course. He got up at 5 a.m. and he worked all day.
And he worked. But there are agents, no, but you say that, Michael. There are agents who feel they work every single day and they don't turn.
They look busy. They're not working. They're doing the photocopy machine talk. You remember the old photocopy machine talk?
Yes.
Where they bitch and complain about their clients and all the horrible stuff that's going on and how this form is horrible and this person did that and I lost my left shoe while I was showing a basement. This is not work. What this agent did is he picked up the phone. He made thousands of phone calls, sent out emails, texts, met with people in person. He did open houses up to the wazoo. He was active. He was out there. He was doing stuff that didn't cost him anything other than his time. That was the secret.
And I can appreciate that.
Well, then let's move
on. But I will say this. So for our listeners, if you're a buyer or a seller, this is a great business to look busy in and not make any money. So for the realtors, you need to be able to identify what are money-making activities. And if you're a new agent, minimal, you should be prospecting 3 to 4 hours a day. You should be not sitting in your home office, not sitting in your office for your brokerage. You should be out having relationships. In whether it's volunteering positions, whether it is your, you know, local school, spheres, restaurants, you should be out every single day in front of people having conversations, which is what it sounds like this young individual. So good for them. They did an awesome job and they probably deserve it.
They do. Congratulations on your hard work. One final little tip on that. I remember one of our trainers from Halifax. David, if you're out there, we miss you.
Yes, we love David.
And your new office looks great. What he told us is don't work from the office. Get your company colors on you. And back in the day, Century 21 had their gold jackets. I've been telling you should get red jackets, put your name tag on them. and hang out at Tim Hortons. Hang out where the people are, because you're going to meet them there. You're not necessarily going to meet them in your home office or an office at your brokerage.
Yes.
Moving along, I have a story. I think I touched on this in one of the other episodes, but this is a reason why documentation is so, so important. So after Fiona, I had somebody that had a home that was completely devastated by Fiona. He found a handyman to do all the work. And for 3 years, that handyman was in that house working away. Every time I would show up, we were 2 weeks away from the completion. 3 years later, we still weren't completed. In fact, it got to the point where I would go up there and check on the work every month or two. And I would say to him, how are things at your new beach house? You know, saying that, did you move in? As it turns out, guess what happened?
No.
He moved in.
Oh.
And I said, I was in a difficult situation because the vendor's telling me, well, I can't find anybody else. And I couldn't find anybody else because he was already there. And I'm not going to send people out there and tell them, pretend they're my best friend from golf looking at a house. So I respected everybody's boundaries. I figured he's running the show, whatever. But the end of the day is 3 years later, approximately nothing was really done. Little projects here and there. The moral of the story is, and I said this to him because he did apologize to me because I kept telling him, like, nothing's happening. Your house is a mess. He wasn't up here to see that, even though I sent him multiple pictures and videos, one of me actually walking through with an action cam from one end to the other. However, the message didn't seem to get conveyed. But the bottom line is, I told him, now that I'm running this project, we're hiring people. This is what they're going to do. This is how much it's going to cost. This is when it's going to be done. In fact, you can even take it a step further and have penalties if it's not completed by the completion date, or discount on the services, whatever the question may be. And miraculously, we've accomplished more in the last month and a half than we've accomplished in the last 3 years.
That poor seller, though, being a property owner, being out so much money at the mercy or feeling like they're trusting somebody that they hired and to be taken advantage of, they probably, so it may have seemed to be expensive at the time to travel up to Prince Edward Island or wherever your home may be to check on it, and, you know, decided, well, a little bit more time. It would have been cheaper for him to have flown up at least in the first year even to check the progress.
He didn't have to do that because I had the video and the pictures. The failure point here is most people are honest. So we usually have a tendency to trust other people. The failure was you have to step back and understand, this is not a friendship. We're not buddies. If we want to be buddies, let's do this after the deal is done or the house has been completely renovated. In the meantime, we need to have contractual agreements in place that spell out the duties, what it's going to cost, and when it's going to be completed, and what happens if it's not completed.
Yeah, the clear expectations of the work to be done.
Next, there's a lot of agents getting full-time jobs as we see the market is softening. The open house signs are going up like daisies in the spring. Price reductions are appearing on the hot sheet that is sent to us daily, or we can view daily, seeing houses that were overpriced being reduced. We've converted over to a balanced market, neither in favor of the sellers or the buyers. So what I'm finding, and I know you have as well, is I'm having a hard time communicating with agents that either were part-time agents to begin with, because there's always a proliferation of agents whenever times are good, and then they quit when times are bad. But I'm submitting offers, and it's taken me 2 days to get a response because they're on training courses or they're not answering the phone. And I know you've had this happen as well. So the point to this is, if you are hiring an agent and you expect full-time service, hire a full-time agent. Ask them if they're working any part-time jobs. Why not?
Yeah, but they may not, as a seller, you may not realize what could end up happening or impacting the sale of your property. And as a buyer, you may just, again, it could be a family member or friend that you are wanting to do a favor to and give them, you know, the sale, the job, if you will. But when you have a part-time agent who has a full-time or even a part-time job, you can run into a whole bunch of issues. So some of the issues, and I'll just kind of quickly define for each side of the transaction. For a seller, they may not be following up in inquiries as the, we call them leads, are coming in. So when an individual is interested in a property, they'll usually click on realtor.ca that I would like more information or I'd like to book a showing. And they'll do this as a seller, you need to know, they may have sent that same little message, click, 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 because it's pretty easy to do on 3, 4, 5 different properties. Well, the agent who is on top of things and responds to them first is going to end up probably being the agent, if they're good, at securing a relationship and able to be a buyer's representative to that buyer. If that agent, obviously, if they've received a message from this buyer, it's because they have a listing that also sparks an interest in this particular buyer. So what are they going to do? They're going to try to promote their property listing. So you want to make sure that as a seller, you have an agent who is full-time, that responds quickly to lead inquiries to keep that captured interest on your property. As well, closing day, you want to make sure that your agent is available. It's not, well, everything's good and the buyer's agent's doing the final walkthrough. Because if there's any issues and it ends up causing, the lawyers are trying to get in touch with the seller, so the seller's agent, so that they can maybe come up with some sort of solution, or the water test is just coming in, or whatever the circumstances are, it may cause your property not to close on that day if the time ticks and is not in your favor anymore. Now, as a buyer's agent, a buyer wanting to hire a part-time buyer's representative, you're in much the same kind of situation where they may not be available on your time schedule to accommodate showings that you have. You may miss out on properties because you can only see them, whether it's the afternoon or only between 5 and 7 in the evening or Saturdays. And if that is their scheduled shift, they're going to try to alter your viewing schedule for a different time that they're actually able to show it, the property to you. Therefore, you may miss out and it may end up under contract. So that's just kind of both sides, what some of the disadvantages can be if you're hiring an agent who has another, whether it's a full-time or part-time job.
Well, look at some of the purchases you've made where it's come on the MLS at 10 o'clock in the morning and you've had it under contract by 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Absolutely.
Because it was an awesome deal and we were watching the market. Actually, I think I tipped you off on that property.
Oh.
I never credit. Did get a kickback or anything, not even a gift.
Oh, Michael. Yes, so you want to make sure that your agent is on the ball and they're watching. Like you had mentioned, Michael, we call it the hot sheet. There are price reductions. On average, there's about 15 to 20 every single day I'm noticing on the hot sheet. So you want to make sure that you have an agent whose fingers on the pulse, making sure that they know what's going on. They're checking that hot sheet. This is what they do. They eat, breathe, and live real estate. Still having a life. I'm not telling somebody to do this 24/7. However, that they're able to best service you regardless of what side of the transaction you're on.
And the most important thing why you would have a full-time real estate agent representing you?
Yeah, because even at closing day, I've had a situation where we couldn't get a hold of the agent on the other side and the property almost didn't close, which is, I was kind of touching on that. It's not good if you can't get a hold of your agent. And there are a lot of workplaces, as soon as they find out that you are a real estate agent, some of them will actually say no phones because they know that you're going to be on your phone or the possibility or the potential. So if you're a buyer or a seller and assuming that your agent is going to be able to, yeah, they'll be able to take calls or follow up, it could cost you money.
Back in the 1980s or so, when you were just a little kid going through grade 4.
Funny.
There is a number of people in the New York City area pumping or advertising PEI properties in the New York Times. And they did it on the pretense that one day, this is back in 1980-something, one day PEI is going to be the next Nantucket, Cape Cod, or Long Island. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do remember
that. In fact, even to this day, and this is what refreshed me, last week I talked to an investment banker from New York City, now retired, and he said the same thing, and it was the same people that brought him up here, and he bought property and paid a lot of money for it. It may or may not even be worth that amount of money today. Maybe it's underwater because it's eroded and disappeared into the ocean or the strait.
Yes, or perhaps the province decided to not allow building permits to be approved.
So is this going to turn into the next Cape Cod, Nantucket, or Long Island?
I don't see that.
It's not. And the reason being, and I've been preaching this for many years, is we do not have a Boston, we do not have a New York, we do not have a Toronto or a Chicago next to us. So unless we have some miraculous thing happen where millions upon millions of people move to this area, we are not going to be the next Nantucket, Cape Cod, or Long Island. So do not buy properties on this basis. Buy properties in PEI because they're beautiful, they're affordable, you can enjoy them for years. You're not going to pay the prices you would in those areas, but don't think that your investment is going to go up by 10,000% in 5 years.
Good advice, Michael.
Well, thank you so much, Patty. Buffer zones and IRAC, not to beat the IRAC topic to death, so we're going to make this quick. Newer subdivisions have a buffer zone in front, which was originally and still is designed to protect you from erosion. They're typically owned by the homeowners association or the original developer prior thereto conveying it to the homeowners association. These buffer zones, according to IRAC, are not IRAC applicable. Therefore, if you buy a waterfront lot that might have over 150 feet or 5 acres, you don't need to go through IRAC. And I reconfirmed this with them on the phone 2 days ago. Anything to quickly add?
As long as the buffer is owned by a developer.
Correct. It's not owned by you. So you're
correct.
Not buying the buffer.
Now, Michael, with regards to that, if it's an HOA where everybody owns a part of it, they will base it on percentages because we've had this
situation. Let's not get complicated because
yes,
now we're getting into shareholding and corporation.
I get it. I just don't want people to think it's a black and white. So there is an area that you would need to do more due diligence. But if it is a developer that still owns or has the buffer zone in their possession, it is not an IRAC applicable property.
I've got an exciting topic for you to cover.
What is that?
The rental car shortage. Should I make sure I have a rental car prior to coming to PEI and flying in or whatever? Or should I just assume that there's going to be 1,000 of them waiting for my arrival?
No, I would say as soon as you know you are booking your travel plans as part of your flight and your accommodations is get that car rental booked. Because there is a shortage of car rentals on the island.
Property taxes on recently subdivided lots have not been established because that lot is still part of the parent parcel. So when someone asks you, what should I expect to pay for property taxes on this waterfront lot, what do you tell them?
Well, what I tell my, if it's an inquiry and I'm the listing agent on it, I will usually have some of this information already on hand. If I'm a buyer's agent and a buyer says, well, there's no property tax amount listed, could you find that out? I would have to advise that buyer, the best that I would be able to do is pull because it is part of the parent parcel or the main parcel yet to be subdivided off, yet to be assigned a property ID number, so therefore yet to be assigned an assessed value and property tax amount, I would look at whatever has sold already within the subdivision and not developed if it's a piece of land to get an approximation of what this particular buyer could expect, depending on the year too that the lot that was sold off within the subdivision was sold. Now, if you are the person buying, being the first one to buy in this new subdivision, again, that it gets a little tricky. You could call the province and have a conversation. they may or may not be able to provide a number because it would be the first property in the area.
They should be able to provide a number based on the assessment value, which shouldn't exceed the purchase price typically.
But there's none. It's a new subdivision.
But they're buying a waterfront lot for $100,000. The assessment value typically, if they all sell for about that same amount, and if that amount is conceivable or would be construed as an average or median value for that property, the province should be able to tell you what the property tax it should be. In addition to that, if you're an island resident, you would receive a discount of approximately a third, but we won't get into that conversation. But they should be able to give you a rough guesstimate based on what you're purchasing it for, assuming you're not overpaying or underpaying.
Or, now you say that, but that's assuming it's already under contract. It's a brand new subdivision and listing, and the seller has thrown out, this is what I want for every single lot. So the value is yet to be confidently determined. Now, the very fact that you're interested in it may have value, but you also don't want to be the first one that ends up paying an inflated price only to find out you paid $100 and the lots were only worth $65.70.
Next subject.
Okay.
I was driving around visiting a property that's on the water, and this property is down a clay road that leads to a gravel road that leads to a clay road, and this clay road traverses through basically swamp for a couple of miles. But the house at the end of the laneway is beautiful. And I thought to myself, what a great spot. I would love to own something like this. But then I thought, real estate brain kicked in, and I said, that road I don't own. And as it turns out, the agreement with the landowner that owns the laneway is basically a verbal contract because he's known them for decades. But that owner is also very old and has health issues and may not be around forever. So the property is going to divert to estate, which will be the family members in this case. Bottom line is, there's nothing in writing that pertains to that road, the maintenance thereof, or it may give some very basic, rudimentary, you can use the laneway on your deed. But I would want to make sure that if I'm buying a property, specifically an expensive property that's down 2 miles or more of road, that I have a substantive agreement pertaining to that road.
And where can they find this information, Michael?
The existing information will be in the deed, presumably.
Correct.
And or there could be restrictive and or protective covenants attached to the deed, but it still reverts back to the deed. But if I'm buying this property, I probably want to make sure that I can use the road. I can even maintain the road. Let's say I want to pave it. I want to have the ability to do that because I don't want to be going down a road. Because, you know, some of them on the island where, you know, there's a 6-foot sinkhole and the water's almost at the bottom of your window. I want to be able to provide services to that road because I'm the only one down there.
Yes, absolutely. So it just one more reason to make sure that if you're looking at properties and you think you can do this on your own, well, if you're local, then you'd be able to go to the registry's office, I guess, and pull the deed and try to get your information if you don't have access to the online platform GeoLink. But if you are looking to buy, have a realtor. They have access to all these tools and services to protect you so that they can pull the deed and take a look and see what the agreement is in place so that you know what to expect or what's not in place.
And before you buy it, get a more substantive agreement in place because in most cases, you can agree or disagree with me, they're not going to be a very good agreement. They're basically going to say, yeah, you can use that laneway.
The older the agreement, I would say, because like you had the case scenario, they were friends or they could have been family, and that's why that piece was originally severed off, whether it's 50 or 100 years ago, because our island now is being populated with more individuals who are non-island residents or they were island born and they'd moved away and they're back. People are a little more litigious today. People are a little more property, you know, oriented in the sense that I want to know where my property lines are and I want to make sure what is mine is mine. But for those who maybe are not from Prince Edward Island, PEI, even as far back as like 15 years ago, so relaxed and laid back. They didn't concern themselves necessarily with property lines and this whole proprietary, this is my property, you don't cross it. You know, once fences started going up, again, 15 to 20 years ago, it was pretty clear that you were not an island resident, because islanders wouldn't have been putting fences up on their properties typically.
Well said, because it's an insult to your neighbor to put up a fence, not so much now, particularly in the city.
Yes.
Patty, in closing, I have the greatest business idea ever, and anyone listening to this podcast can certainly capitalize on this. You've heard of all these sites that rate real estate agents?
Yes.
And some of them take to them and turn them into a passionate hobby, collecting reviews and star rating and thumbs ups.
Yes.
I came up with an idea to have a system that rates clients, buyers and sellers of real estate, so we don't get stuck with any more nut jobs. What do you think?
Well, I wouldn't say the public are nut jobs, but that, again, would be then subjective, because what one person may consider you're a bit of a handful, to somebody else, they speak the same language.
I say we do it like Uber.
No.
If they're going to review the agents, we should be able to review the clients. That way, down the road, when we have someone that's problematic, we can share that experience so we're aware of it. Just an idea. I just think there's too many rating systems that rate agents, and usually the only people that rate the agents are negative people. And the positive ones are usually testimonials that are solicited in most cases, but no one's rating the client, the buyer or the seller. Let's wrap it up.
Thanks again for listening to another episode of the Michael and Patty Show, otherwise known as MAPS, Prince Edward Island's podcast that completely pertains to buying and selling and a little bit of PEI fun facts. If you're new to the podcast, this is about what you could expect. Michael and
no,
I will
cover... they're never
going
to come back.
Michael and I cover a multitude of topics where we discuss them. We both have some things we agree on and some things we don't agree on. And it offers an opportunity for hopefully you as the listener to really feel like you're getting a full view of what you could, should, and can expect. So we appreciate every one of you for listening and downloading our podcast. We also look forward to all our listeners continuing to look up the Moving to Prince Edward Island from the Michael and Patty Show Facebook group, which is a continuation of this, so that you can continue to just be part of the conversation and throw your questions out and just keep everyone being well informed.
So when you go to Facebook, search for the Michael and Patty Show.
Moving to Prince Edward
Moving
Island.
Moving to Prince Edward Island. Michael and Patty Podcast is exactly what it's called. And if you have any questions about PEI real estate, PEI in general, or just real estate in general, put them in the Facebook group. Have a great day. And thanks again for listening.
Thanks for listening. Have a great day.